Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Why do you think it is that we decided to go with five listener questions on every one of these episodes?
It's half of 10. It's five times one. I mean,
you have five fingers on one hand. Is that
exactly.
It? I don't know.
That way I could count very easily.
I guess we just decided that we could squeeze five questions into an episode without running too long. We don't want folks sitting around for like, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours listening to us answer listener questions.
Yeah, if it's just one question, then people expect a really, really verbose response. And, you know, most of these questions, that's not necessary.
That's true.
Yeah, then if we had 100 questions to answer in an episode. So, I don't know, five is nice, you know, right there in between one and 100. But just not right in the middle.
But. You know, right between one and 100. Let's go with five. Yeah, well, on that note, we have our questions to get to. We're going to share our thoughts on Bitcoin. We had a listener who had a question about our thoughts on Bitcoin. We're going to talk about fixing a credit card mistake. And we also had a question from a listener who has half of his savings in Coca-Cola company stock. And so we're going to share our thoughts on that.
Move it all to Pepsi. I'm just going to say. That's my knee-jerk reaction.
You're from the greater Atlanta area, so
yeah,
you grew up drinking Coke.
I would never tell him to do that.
I grew up drinking Pepsi, 100%. I mean, I grew up in Augusta, which is very much still Coca-Cola territory.
Well, that's where the brain damage came from, huh?
That and, what, the Savannah River site, the radiation leaks. That's what we always... There's always that fear. Even as a kid, I remember in the back of my mind thinking... Because, you know, on The Simpsons, they've got the nuclear plant, and there's always... It's always kind of like an ongoing, you know, mild grade threat in the background. And I wonder if that led to any anxiety on my part, or if it just means I don't care about anything because it didn't affect me.
Right.
Anyway, I grew up drinking Pepsi, and that is not what we're going to recommend to that listener, but we are going to talk about his specific situation and for others who might be in a similar situation. We're going to get to those three questions plus a couple others during this episode. But Joel, first, real quick, I wanted to mention how I've been on an eBay kick lately. The listeners might remember, a couple months ago, I talked about selling some of my photography gear. It's been sitting around, not doing anything, not earning any money for me, only depreciating. And I thought, you know, I've got to get my act together. I need to take some pictures, need to write up some listings, and get these jokers listed on eBay.
That feels like a conundrum, though. How do you take pictures of the equipment you're supposed to be taking pictures with?
I will say I did hang on to one body. because I thought, I'm still going to want to take some, you know, nicer pictures of the family, different things maybe that we need to take pictures of for How to Money. But I did all of that. I got all that equipment listed. And, dude, over the past few weeks, I have over $10,000 in sales.
Dang.
Just right there on eBay.
Nicely done.
Yeah, thanks, man. And I wanted to mention that, too, because I've been eBaying for a long time, like close to 20 years. I sold my first item when I was back in college.
What was the first item you sold? Do you remember?
Oh, great question. I don't know. I don't even know if I can go back and look. But I do remember early on unloading a bunch of CDs because I had ripped them all onto my laptop. And I remember thinking, CDs are like going to be in the past.
You're going to have to explain what those are for our 20-something-year-old listeners.
I'm not talking about certificate of deposits.
They probably don't know what those are either.
Talking about musical compact discs. Anyway, but I wanted to mention it because over all those years, man, it's been a minute since I have sold something on eBay. And they have made it so much easier. They've just completely streamlined the process. And it made me realize that this is going to be something I'm going to revisit and do more often.
Yeah.
It made me realize that just little random things I've got laying around the house, I think I'm going to start putting them on a shelf. It's going to be my eBay shelf because they're things that are either brand new that we didn't actually use. So, for instance, we have some printer ink for a printer that we no longer have. And it's perfectly new in the package. And I'm like, wait a minute. I was getting ready to toss it, or I was going to put it on a free cycle kind of thing. But then I thought, I could probably sell this for $20 because that's like a 35 little box of ink, brand new. But different things like that. And with how easy they make it, either using the app or just, you know, uploading the images online, it felt so much more accessible than what I remembered eBay being in the past. And too, just the way they do shipping, because you can purchase your shipping now online and they'll deduct the cost of that label from your earnings. And so you don't even see that exit. Like, it makes it nice and clean within my budget as well. And because we get so many things shipped to us in the mail, like we've already got these envelopes and boxes laying around the house anyway. And so, I don't know, I feel like...
Recycling them.
Seriously. And so I feel like all of these things coming together has led me to realize that, man, I am going to get back on my eBay game. And I'll keep you posted because I set aside our old laptop as well. Because we almost just gave it away because I thought, who is going to want to buy, a 10-year-old MacBook Air?
Yeah.
But then I hopped on there. There's people buying 10-year-old MacBook Airs.
What are they, like $150
bucks
or something?
Yeah, a couple hundred bucks,
I mean, that's a lot of money for...
And it's perfectly functioning. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. And a lot of those are busted.
Well, that's good to know because, Emily, we just got her a new laptop because the old one was slow. And I'm like, but it's still like a 2014 MacBook Pro or something.
There's nothing wrong with that.
It was like kind of functioning like garbage, but somebody probably wants that.
Somebody will pay for that
for spare parts or whatever.
You have an eBay account where you've sold stuff before?
Yeah, but it's been a while, so yeah. I need to get into that again. And I'm sure I could find a ton of things around my house just by spending a few minutes to sell and make a little bit of side cash.
Make some of that weekend cash, and it's better than Facebook Marketplace too, man. Because sometimes with larger items, obviously, Facebook Marketplace is easy because you don't have to ship it.
Yeah, local pickup.
But then you're dealing with people who don't show up. And then they say they're going to show up, save it for me, and then somebody else that wanted it. You missed out on being able to sell it to them because then they went ahead and bought it new or got it from somebody else, that kind of thing. There's just that headache factor. And I am willing to pay a cut to eBay in order to not have to deal with that and just to kind of ship it out. You've got a single shipping day if you've got a few items to mail off at the same time. Makes it easy.
Yeah, I think they're both helpful for different items and depending on what you're trying to do. Like I sold an old washer and dryer recently on Facebook yard sale. That doesn't really work on eBay. Yeah. The shipping costs are prohibitive. But yeah, I agree. It is a little bit of a pain messaging back and forth with 20 different people to find the person that's actually going to show up and buy the product.
But, exactly.
All right. Well, let's move on, Matt. Let's mention the beer that we're having on today's episode. This one is called Master Shredder. It brings me back to my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle 11 days. Who was your favorite Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, by the way?
Well, obviously Leonardo, because he had the blades, right? I mean, he had the two swords. But
see, I'm Michelangelo guy myself.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. So you were all about the nunchucks.
I'm a party dude,
I had a thing for Donatello. He had the stick.
He's like your spirit turtle. I can see that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know. Was he like the oldest brother or something like that? He always seemed like the most
responsible,
cool-headed, like kind of chill. And so I felt a spiritual draw to the turtle wielding the stick. What's the proper term? Is it like a
bow?
I don't know.
Yeah. Who knows? But yeah.
Raphael always got the shaft.
Nobody wanted to. Those were scythes, what he was
okay.
Throwing.
That's okay.
But the staff, whatever Donatello had. Yeah.
Big
but,
stick.
Yeah. We digress. This beer is brewed by the Vail Brewing Company. And Matt, they make some good stuff. Looking forward to sharing this one with you on today's episode. But let's get to listener questions. If anybody out there has a question they want to pose to you and me, there's an easy way to submit it. Just go to our website at howtomoney.com/ask. It'll take you 2 minutes to toss your question our way, and hopefully we can get to it on the next Ask HTM episode. Matt, this first question comes from a listener who wants to know our thoughts on crypto.
Hi there, this is Chelsea Furick from Santa Maria, California, and I wanted to get both of your guys' opinion on Bitcoin. Thank you.
Matt, I gotta say, I love the short and sweet questions. She just gets right to the point.
She's
Thank you.
Cut to the chase.
Thank you, Chelsea. This one is really, really straightforward from the listener question standpoint. But from the answering standpoint, there's a lot more nuance that we have to throw in there when it comes to our thoughts on Bitcoin specifically. And Matt, I think we should talk just about kind of crypto in general for a second. But why don't you get us started, because you are a little more bullish than I am on
you
this.
You think I am?
I think a little bit more.
Yeah, okay. So I actually opted to invest a super small overall portion of my investments into crypto, both Bitcoin as well as Ethereum, about 7 months ago. And actually, it was our conversation with Jacob Goldstein back in episode 319 that finally convinced me.
Which was a really fun conversation. He wrote a book about the history of money, and it was just kind of fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. And so here's the thing. It's not that he made the recommendation that we should or shouldn't invest in Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies. But as we talked about the history of money, he explained how it all came down to trust. As the collective confidence increases in a given form of currency, right? And he kind of talked through some of the different examples. And so whether that be like shells or coins or paper money or money that's like printed on leather, that belief is what enables a currency to actually function and to actually work properly. So even though I do believe that the fundamentals, that the technological advances should eventually lead to just a wider adoption of cryptocurrencies, That's nothing if there isn't buy-in and others who actually believe in it as well. You could have the most brilliant idea, and if you're not able to sell it to people, if folks aren't willing to commit and give it a try, it doesn't really matter. And so at this point, I feel that it's more about the fact that there is more collective confidence within crypto. And so for me, that was definitely the point that I had gotten to when it sort of clicked in my mind that, you know what, it's not even, I don't have to perfectly understand the blockchain. I don't have to perfectly understand all of the applications for this technology, but I felt, for me personally at least, that we had reached a sort of critical mass to where at least I was willing to jump in.
Yeah, Matt and I actually followed suit just last month. I decided to put a little bit of money into Bitcoin and Ethereum as well.
And you got it on sale too. That's because you're like, ah, I don't know about before, but now with the prices as low as they are, you're like, I can see myself getting into it a little bit.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, I got in right when Bitcoin was down at about like $30,000 a Bitcoin. But really, there's just so much volatility in the crypto space. But I feel like even in the midst of that volatility, we've seen some added stability to Bitcoin and Ether that hadn't really existed before. And I feel like you said, Matt, there is this sort of wide adoption that's happening. We're seeing more countries and companies adopting cryptocurrency and taking that as a form of payment. There's more institutional belief that some forms of crypto can and will be used in real life. And yeah, because of that, I felt compelled to have at least some exposure in the space. Another example, Matt, that really kind of made me think, oh yeah, I'm glad that I hold at least some cryptocurrency, was the second largest mortgage lender in the United States. They're going to start accepting payment in Bitcoin later this year. So yeah, these use case scenarios are playing out as Bitcoin is being more legitimized, right? And as more institutions adopt Bitcoin, more individuals are going to as well. If you can pay your mortgage with Bitcoin, or if you can check out at Walmart using Bitcoin, then more and more people are going to see it as a secure and reliable form of payment. And I feel like the adoption curve was growing enough that it made me at least interested to have like a small stake in that.
Sure.
In that space.
Yeah, yeah. And as you know, you give some examples of different institutions adopting cryptocurrencies. As more institutions adopt Bitcoin, more individuals will then also follow suit, right? Like, it really is this potentially like endless feedback loop. Even the fact that we talk about crypto here on the show, I think that might, you know, like, gets all of our listeners out there just a little bit more comfortable with the idea of it. And so, like, maybe you're listening and you think, you know, why not? I'll just put $100 in. You know, of course, this is assuming you're in a healthy financial position. But as more individuals make that small move personally, more money enters into the cryptocurrencies, into Bitcoin, more companies and countries will then likely make that move too. And then this repeats again and again. And so, yeah, keep in mind, you know, we're not recommending that you go all in. Like, please don't do that. But I am definitely comfortable with having some play money just on the side, you know, that might see some serious volatility. But of course, there's also the chance to see that investment go up in value as well. The way I think about it right now is sort of like, imagine cryptocurrencies being like this brand new path that somebody's like trailblazing into the woods, right? Like, you've got the main path, the path that most people take, and you see this person, like, maybe, I don't know, taking a shortcut, but it's kind of hard going. And you, and if you're that person and you're doing it all alone, well, there's not much good there, even though the fundamentals might be right, where it's just like, hey guys, this is a shortcut, or this is going to be a path to a great view. It's going to be more difficult when there's not a lot of people also going on that path, right? So it's kind of hard going. You're having to like whack down, you know, bushes, there's big rocks in the way. But as you go down that path and as other people join you, well, the path becomes a little bit more and more well-worn. And then before you know it, folks who said that they would never go down that path are looking at it and they're like, okay, I've seen people go down that path, check out that view and come back. You've actually seen them do that. And so there's going to be more individuals, I think, who are willing to take that step. You don't have to go all in and take this massive plunge, but we do think that it is worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah. And even you and I, right, have changed our position to a certain degree when it comes to cryptocurrency. I think we were never against it, but for a long time, you and I had no stake. We had no position in it. And we
zero interest in it.
But we really actually still recommend the same thing to listeners who want to get involved in it. And we're taking the same approach ourselves, even though we now have a little bit of Bitcoin and Ether, very little. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where we recommend you think in the same terms. Like, because we don't know which specific coins are going to be the winners and losers in the space.
Yeah, there's a lot of unanswered questions,
right?
For sure.
We don't know if threats of greater regulation are going to help help or hurt the adoption of cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of evidence that either one of those things could happen, right? But there's still a lot of speculation going on in the space too. So I would be careful before putting much money there. You know, our general rule of thumb is that you should use at most 5% of your investment money to play around with. Make sure that you're maximizing your exposure to index funds inside of traditional retirement accounts first. And if you've got some money left over that you're willing to put at risk, it's okay to put some of that money in Bitcoin or into other cryptocurrencies that you're interested in. Bitcoin being the one that has the most proven path, right? The sure. most well-trodden path, Matt, to use your analogy. But yeah, it's still important, I think, to proceed slowly and to not get reckless in this space, because there's just a lot more proven track record when it comes to the path of investing in index funds, in the yes. stock market, inside tax-advantaged accounts. So we would say, put 95% of your efforts there. But if you really want to, you know, putting a small amount of the money that you have available to invest into the crypto space, we're okay with that.
Yeah, well, and another thing too is that we wouldn't recommend this to anyone if they're going to get stressed about it, right? Or like if you think it's going to take up too much of your mental bandwidth, we would say that this is something you should avoid, because at that point, it's just not going to, you know, it's not going to be worth the toll that it's going to take on you. And if that's who you are and you can identify that, that's totally fine. You can let other folks like us gingerly try it out, and we'll keep you posted. We can be the canaries in the coal mine, though we don't consider ourselves to be, you know, on the cutting edge by any stretch. We're still pretty late to the game by Bitcoin standards, and we are still retaining a healthy skepticism.
Do you have the laser eyes in your profile on Twitter yet?
Got the diamond hands. No, I mean, we are interested in it, and like you said, Joel, over time, as it becomes something that is more proven, like, it's obviously going to be more volatile, so there's no question about that compared to the traditional stock market. But I'm willing to say that my view towards cryptocurrencies over the next several years will likely change. And I think it's healthy to change and to reassess and reevaluate things. But for now, right now, this is where you and I stand when it comes to cryptocurrency.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens in the future.
Yeah.
And I want at least a very small bit of exposure to Bitcoin and, you know, some of the other potentially popular cryptocurrencies. But it's a space we'll be focused on and we will continue to talk about on the show. So Chelsea, thanks for your question and best of luck in dipping your toe in the water.
5% or less.
Yes, exactly. We have more questions to get to though, Matt, including one about the guy who owns a heck of a lot of Coca-Cola stock. We'll get to that question and more right after this break.
All right, Joel, we are back from the break. We're taking listener questions, and our next question comes from a couple who is doing a killer job with their money. They just want to know what they should be doing next.
Hey, Matt and Joel. My name is Zoe from Albany, New York. I love the pod, and today I have a question about my short to medium term financial goals. In the podcast, you talk a lot about emergency funds and long-term investing, and I have about 6 months worth of expenses in my emergency fund and am regularly contributing to a 401k with an employer match. My husband and I also own a two-family house that we live in and rent out half of to pay the mortgage. We're saving to buy another home in about 2 to 5 years, depending on how quickly we can save. My question is, what should we do with that money? Should we invest it? And if so, in what? Or should we keep it sitting in our savings? I should also mention that we have a baby on the way. Thanks so much for all your great advice.
Zoe, first off, we got to wish you a congrats on that baby.
Yeah.
Always exciting to bring another baby into the fam. And I feel like too, Matt, I don't know about you, but having the first baby really was a big deal in terms of getting some motivation
with
financial goals. It made me want to pursue certain things like with even greater fervor, just to kind of feel like I was financially ready to bring that baby into the world.
Totally. Having a partner, that's one thing, because it's like, okay, you can always just, you know, find a new partner. Like if I were to die.
And you're smart enough to probably, you know, do okay on
your
own.
You can work. But a baby, it's like, oh my gosh, this is a human being that's
a poor, defenseless life.
That is completely helpless. And there's nothing else that they can do except for cry and poop and nurse.
Well, it sounds like that is what Zoe is doing though, right? Like that she and her partner are focused on great things before this baby comes into the world, and that they've been doing it for a while. They're house hacking right now, which is awesome. What a great way to build up your savings and to be able to ramp up your ability to invest more money really quickly. And basically, you know, with this investment property and the stocked E fund that they've got, and also those regular contributions
to those
retirement accounts, they're setting themselves up really nicely. And yeah, when you've got those ducks in a row, a question like this really does allow for a whole lot more flexibility when it comes to choosing what's right for Zoe and her family in the coming years.
Exactly. And so, Zoe, let's get to your question here about where to put this money that you plan on putting towards a house. These medium-term investing goals can be the hardest thing to get right. And specifically, a 2 to 5 year window is really tricky. That's because I would take a very different path with a 2 year kind of time frame than I would with a 5 year time frame, right? They're almost like two different questions. And so that's kind of how we're going to answer this. So much of this kind of comes down to your actual timeline and to your particular risk tolerance. And so if you definitely need that money closer to the 24 months from now, I would forego investing altogether, or I'd at least be very conservative with that money that you're investing, because of the massive spread in the interest that you'll earn between savings or a CD versus an I bond. We would recommend that you shovel more of that money into something like an I bond, which you can do up to $10,000 per year. That would make sense, and that would be a safe place for you to put this money that was kind of like on the short to medium term length of time.
Yeah, but you're right, Matt. It is a tricky question, because 2 year money and 5 year money is, there's kind of a different answer to each one of those.
Right.
It's a tricky time frame. But if the time frame is more flexible and you actually do have 5 years until you plan to use it,
that's a different story.
I would say put it to work.
Yep.
I'd personally feel comfortable putting quite a bit of that money in the market if my timeline was that lengthy, in particular with rates on savings being as low as they are right now. But if you aren't willing or able to stomach the ups and downs in, let's say, like a total stock market fund because of potential market volatility that you could experience, consider investing the money, but just doing so more conservatively. So instead of a different savings vehicle like an I bond that we might recommend on 2 year money, a target date fund that's closer to now than closer to your actual target date could give you a nice mix of stocks and bonds that'll make your investing ride a bit smoother. So investing that money in like a 2025 or 2030 target date fund could be the right move for you. Most folks only consider target date funds for retirement, but they can also work well for a goal that you might have 4 years from now. You just gotta pick a different target date fund.
Exactly. And of course, you're not putting that in a retirement account. You're putting it in a taxable brokerage account. And the other thing too, when you're looking at these target date funds, make sure that you get one with a lower expense ratio, like something around like 0.1, 0.2%, and avoid some of those funds out there that are charging you like 0.7, 0.8, 0.9%. We mentioned Vanguard and Fidelity a bunch here on the show because they are great. But for example, Fidelity, they have a 2025 target date fund that costs 0.12%, but they also have one that costs 0.63%. And they're very similar in performance. So they're both 2025 funds.
I'm so thrown off by that. I don't really quite understand why Fidelity has two options and why they differ so much when it comes to the expense ratio. But yeah, if you're going to go with one of those with Fidelity, which Fidelity's great, it's a great choice. Make sure you choose the one that has an expense ratio that's half a point less.
Yeah, I mean, you might, if you look at the short term, like the near term results, there might be some difference in performance, but that's the thing. We also have gone through something crazy over the past couple of years, and so that's going to impact the performance of the 1 year and the 3 year significantly. Because you look at, let's say, the 10 year performance on those, and it's virtually the same. Actually, the cheaper fund does better over 10 years, and so that's just something to keep in mind. And Zoe, we kind of mentioned lifestyle too at the beginning. It's important to keep in mind how set you are on making sure that money is available for you when you want to buy that new place. Because you're talking about having this baby. If you know that in exactly 2.5 years, I am going to want more space. We're both working from home now. We're going to have a baby room. We still want to have a guest room, say, for family when they come and visit. That might lead me to be more conservative with my money and to hang on to it for it to be accessible. Compare that to if you didn't really care, right? So say if you're in 5 years, it might be nice to be able to have that new place. But if the market's down, we would just let it ride out for another year or two until the market's recovered.
Yeah, if you can be patient.
Exactly. Yeah, if you can be patient and you have more flexibility on what your life looks like, then that would be a situation where I would be much more comfortable investing that money and taking a little bit more risk.
No doubt, man. I totally agree. So Zoe, best of luck to you and your fam. And we hope that was helpful and instructive for what you do next with this money. And Matt, let's get to the next question on our list. This one has some similarities. It's about saving money, but this one revolves around whether holding a large position in an individual stock is a good idea in that case.
Hey, Joel and Matt, it's Jason from Rochester, New York. You guys have been talking quite a bit about these I-bonds, and it looks like you're somewhere between 1% and 3% yield on them. I kind of went a different route, and I have about half of my savings in Coca-Cola stock. I know there's five or 10 large cap companies that offer pretty good dividends, and I'm just wondering what you think about the idea of doing that rather than investing in something like an I-bond. Thanks.
Hey, Jason, that is true. I-bonds. We've been talking a lot about I-bonds. We actually just did with Zoe's question right before yours. But putting your savings in stock, here's the thing. Like, don't get us wrong. We love Coke, but investing...
Somebody likes Pepsi more. Some dummy.
I've changed my ways. I won't say that. And my dad, he's changed his ways too. He used to be all about Pepsi. Now he likes Coke. It all comes down to that taste test, right? Because like you have one little sip of Pepsi and you're like, oh, I think I want that. But you have an entire glass of Pepsi and you say, oh, that's too much.
A little too sweet.
Yeah. But Jason, like, we do think Coke is a great company. We actually prefer the beverage over Pepsi as well. But investing your actual savings, even in a company as solid and as long-standing as Coke, is putting that money at higher risk than we would recommend. Last March, the valuation of Coke stock dropped alongside with the rest of the market, and their stock price was cut almost in half. Granted, drops like that are rare, but those types of events don't happen with money that you have stashed within a savings account.
Yeah, and Jason, you mentioned that you were doing this with half your savings, though. So at least you have access to some risk-free money on the sidelines in what I'm assuming is a basic savings account. And here's the thing, that the better your financial situation gets over the years, the more risk you are able to realistically take on. Just kind of like we were talking about earlier, Matt, the longer your time horizon, the more you can take on risk and be okay with it. Well, for instance, if you've paid off your mortgage and your monthly expenses are low, you've got more wiggle room to keep a smaller emergency fund on hand, right? You can take a riskier strategy because, like you're doing, with some of that money, even though it's not something that, you know, we would say is ideal to have your savings, in particular in a single stock, to have money that you need to have on hand. If we're talking about an overabundance of savings, then I guess, yeah, you can get a little riskier with it.
Right. And so that's assuming somebody is in a really great financial position. But let's say instead that your financial situation is maybe a little bit precarious. Let's say you've got a ton of student loan debt. Maybe you've also got a mortgage. Maybe you have a job that comes with a little bit of uncertainty. If your finances are more precarious, then you should lean harder towards the certainty of cash within a savings account. Ultimately, you've got to know the overall risk of having some of your savings in an individual stock and how much a specific risk that poses to your specific finances. So for instance, if Coke stock took a similar hit to, you know, what it did this past spring, or, you know, spring of 2020, like, would you be able to weather it even if an emergency did arise? Or is there a chance that you would be forced to sell at an inopportune time and then lock in those actual losses? That's what we're trying to get you to avoid here.
Yeah, and it's important to note that a lot of time when emergencies arise, sometimes they can be completely individualistic, right? Like, my air conditioner went out and I wasn't expecting it, and now I have to fork over $4,500 to get a new one. That is one type of emergency circumstance. But a lot of times emergencies happen in the overall economy that cause a whole lot of individual emergencies for people, like the loss of a job or something like that due to pullbacks from an employer. And yeah, you might
find something as global as a virus.
Right. And so, yeah, you might have, a lot of people found themselves in a position last March where if they needed emergency money and they had it locked up in an individual stock, they would have had to sell right at the worst possible time. And we don't want you to be in that position. So that is why we never recommend investing your emergency fund savings money, right? That's money you want to have liquid and accessible so that you won't get hosed if you found yourself in a position like that. And again, there's nothing wrong with Coke. This applies to even owning something as general as an S&P 500 fund or a total stock market fund. Looking back, if you would have put your emergency fund in the S&P during the summer of 2000, you would have seen losses of 40% by the summer of 2002.
Ouch.
Right? It's the same thing with the Great Recession. Had you put your emergency fund in the S&P 500 again in the summer of 2007, you would have realized losses of over 50% if you pulled that money out in March of 2009, right? The point of having your emergency fund in savings is so that you can count on that money being there when you need it. So investing savings that you need on hand, if the crap were to hit the fan, that is something you want to avoid.
Exactly. And, you know, maybe some of the problem here, it might come down to the broad term of savings, Jason, because, you know, you can have money in savings that you want on hand for immediate emergencies, Or you might have money in your savings for plans that are just 3 years out. There's a big difference between an emergency fund and money that you're saving and, you know, saving up to put towards a new house, like we talked about there with Zoe. And so, again, in this case, it's less about the term savings and where that money actually is, and it's more about your time frame and what you plan on doing with that money. You always want to make sure you have liquid cash to handle any bumps in the road. But beyond that, if you're saving towards something bigger on a shorter time frame, so let's say something that's 2 or 3 years from now, that is money that we would be okay with if you were to want to start to invest that money. So Jason, hopefully we're able to point you in the right direction, and also hopefully you didn't feel picked on because I love that you have, like, you're trying to find ways to maximize your returns, and it sounds like you listen to the show, I'm guessing you might be in a solid financial position. And so I love that you're thinking of different ways to maximize the return that you're seeing on your money.
No doubt. And there are a lot of people that are bummed at the rates that they're receiving for savings right now, Matt, and understandably so. It is a tough climate to be a saver. But when we're talking about short-term money, like we have over the last two questions, there just aren't that many options for people who have a short timeline that don't involve a whole lot of risk. And again, you might be, you know, like someone who likes to do base jumping or ride the craziest roller coasters at the amusement park, right? Like, I don't know what your risk tolerance is, but you just have to understand at least the risky downside that you might be embarking on if you're putting money that's intended to be used in the next year or two into something as risky as an individual stock.
So once you start talking about base jumping, though, then we have to start diving into whether or not we're talking about perceived risk or actual risk, because there are things that we do every day that are actually risky, and there are other things like base jumping that seem riskier than they are in reality.
It's really? I'd like to see some stats on base jumping. I don't know how risky it is. It seems like it is.
Base jumping, skydiving is not as risky as you might think.
Okay, yeah. All right. That's.
I'm not saying I want to do it. I mean, literally, at this point in my life, I have zero interest in going skydiving.
All right.
Not something I want to do.
I've been on a motorized hang glider, but I've never done.
You have?
Yeah, in Hawaii, actually. It was awesome.
Ooh.
I've always wanted to do, because I saw this guy one time when I was in Chattanooga on top of Lookout Mountain. He put together his hang glider, non-motorized, mm-hmm. and I saw him just run
down it together
the side
like
of the mountain and just take off, and I was like, okay, I want to do that someday, so we'll see if I make it.
But that's pretty crazy.
At least it's less risky than I thought it was. But we've got actually a couple more questions to get to on this episode, including one about a 403B. That's the retirement account that most teachers have access to. And we'll get to that question and another one right after this break.
Back. Let's not waste any time. Let's get to our next question about a credit card mistake.
Hi, Joel and Matt. My name is John. I'm from Tucson, Arizona. I inadvertently opened a credit card with a major airline and realized that I opened the wrong credit card and went and opened the right credit card. So now I have two credit cards with this same airline. I was wondering if I could go ahead and close out the first credit card or if I should just keep it and not use it. I'm concerned how opening two credit cards so close together affects my FICO score. So any advice would be great. My FICO score is over 800, so it's not like it'd be too bad. So anyways, thanks for your advice.
Oh, John, so sorry that happened to you. It's a good thing that this is really, in the scheme of things, a pretty minor mess
up.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think it's kind of like accidentally spilling water on your driveway. It's like, bummer, I spilled my water. But if you spilled, like, let's say maple syrup on the carpet, like a whole bottle of it, that's a much bigger cleanup.
On the inside of your house.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a much bigger cleanup duty. So fortunately, John, you made more the water on the driveway mistake than the maple syrup on the carpet.
You got like the bucket full of suds there with, like, you're washing the car and you're like, oh, I just spilled a little bit. It didn't matter. Like, no big deal at all. And so what we're saying to you, John, is that you can go ahead and close that card if you don't want it hanging around, because your credit score, it is already in tip top shape. And so that small hit that you'll take by closing it, it won't actually impact you very much. Or if it does, it won't impact you for very long. Normally, we're pretty anti-closing a credit card, but specifically in your case, and you didn't mention too whether or not it has an annual fee, but if it does, definitely close it if you're not going to be getting any value from that card. But even outside of the fact that it you know, even if it's a free card, we think you can go ahead and close it. And that would not be something that I would sweat. I've actually done this myself, Joel. Maybe 5 years ago, I opened the wrong card. I was opening a business credit card for the photography company. And instead of getting the cash version of the card, like the cash rewards, I got the miles rewards. I guess the links were like right next to each other. And I realized it too late, but I'll go ahead and use the card here for a little bit. I, you know, got whatever rewards I was able to get from it. But then I went ahead and turned around and closed that card within a few months. I didn't sweat it, and it didn't have much impact on my credit score at all.
Yeah, it's usually going to be a short-term thing for most people. But let's talk about actually closing credit cards in general, because sometimes it can have a worse effect than that. I mean, so that's why we generally side with the fact that it's often a bad idea, right? In John's situation, he's got pretty much perfect credit. And with this being like this accidental open, it's a brand new card that he's closing. It's just not that big of a deal. But closing a credit card is a bad idea for most people most of the time. And the main reason is that it lowers your credit utilization rate. So when we answer this question and we tell John to go ahead and close this card, we don't want you to go out and then be like, I'm just going to close two of the cards I normally use and stick with this other one and use it for all my spending.
Joel
or something
said
like that.
It was no biggie.
Right, exactly. That's what we don't want to be accused of, because counter to intuition, it reflects well on you when you have copious amounts of debt available to you. And the main reason is because that...
Yeah, you having, have those high credit lines, man. I want that card with a 20,000 limit. Yeah.
Exactly. The higher your limits, and the less you spend, it improves your credit utilization rate, which is one of the top things that the credit bureaus are looking at when they're determining your credit score. It has a massive impact on that. So yeah, closing a card, especially one that has a large limit, it means that you're going to have less debt available to you. So it immediately will take your score down a notch. So yeah, for John, it's fine. For a lot of other people, it could have an impact on your score depending on how long you've had that card and how big of a credit line it has.
Yeah, so you mentioned depending on how long you've had that card. So let's talk about the length of history as well. Because in John's case, this shouldn't be a big deal, because it sounds like he's been building up a great credit score over a long period of time. And so closing that accidentally open card, it shouldn't hurt him in a meaningful way, because he already had a killer score before getting that newest airline card. So another example, let's say that you've got just three credit cards. You're thinking about closing the card that you've had open the longest. Well, your length of credit history makes up around 15% of your overall credit score. And so for you, if that was your case, you know, you've got one card you've had for, say, 7 years, and you've got two cards that you've had only open for 1 year. If you close that 7-year card, that could lead to a substantial hit to your credit score. And so that's just what we want you to keep in mind as you're thinking through whether you should or whether you shouldn't close that card. There's an article up on the website that discusses closing a credit card in more detail and when it makes sense for you to close a credit card, when it makes sense for you to keep that thing around.
And again, very few scenarios where it makes sense to close a card. But in John's case, like, why not? It's not a big deal. It is a minor, minor mistake. So don't ever think of John. Close that card, be done with it, and move on with your life. But Matt, let's get to the next question that we've got. This one comes from a listener in New York. She's a teacher, and she's got questions about how she should go about investing.
Hey there, Matt and Joel. This is Emily, a teacher from New York State. In addition to a 403b account, I recently learned of something called a 457, which is available for state employees. I'm wondering if you could explain the differences between the two accounts and how they work to fund your retirement. I'm also quite interested in deciding which to fund first if I don't necessarily receive any kind of a match, but I am working towards a pension someday. Thanks, guys, for all you do. Cheers!
Emily, cheers to you. And we are so pumped to hear that you are interested in investing more of your paycheck. But honestly, at the same time, we're a little bummed, because these accounts can be pretty lame. And so a little bit of background here first. The closest cousin to 457s and 403bs is the 401k. And so they actually work really similarly with the same contribution limits of $19,500.
If we're talking about cousins, I got to say the 401k is like the much more industrious cousin, who is much more accomplished and generally just much better than the other ones.
He's like the cousin in any Wes Anderson film in Fantastic Mr. Fox. We're talking about Kristoff.
Yeah, right.
Cousin that came to visit?
And he was like way better than, I forget the other kid's name in there, but yeah, he's just like showing up his cousin at every turn.
Much more athletic. The 401k is the superior cousin in this case. And the cool thing is, though, is that if you have both of these accounts available to you, you are allowed to invest in both. And so total, that's $38,000 annually that you could set aside for retirement if you can can afford to. And that is definitely some good news.
Yes. By the way, Fantastic Mr. Fox, one of the greatest movies of all time.
It's really good.
But let's get back to the question. Sadly, these plans, Emily, are almost never as good as what private sector workers have access to. Hence why we refer to the 403B plans as the much inferior cousin. And that's because the fees are sky high. There was a study, Matt, that I read, and it said that teachers are throwing away $10 billion collectively each
so
year
much money.
Because of these over-the-top fees. It is so much money. Many are paying over 2% in fund management, funded management fees.
Which is crazy because I'm like, I'm over here splitting hairs as to whether or not I should be investing in a fund that charges me 0.015%.
Right.
Or should I go with the free version? It's just like, oh, is it worth it? Should I pay for the S&P name over that fund or get something that's equivalent?
Right. At that point, you're talking pennies.
It's
and
dumb.
We're talking gold bricks in this case with Emily's decision,
totally,
right?
Totally, totally.
So yeah, many products in 403B plans are basically illegal to even be offered in 401k plans because they're so awful. And the annuity offerings in these plans are the most egregious. So it's a travesty, I think. And it's still kind of hard for us to believe that ripoff plans for teachers are still the norm, that they're not the exception to the rule, but they are the rule.
Yeah.
It's no wonder, Matt, that less than a third of teachers actually contribute to these plans because they're basically being hoodwinked and swindled in these plans when they do choose to invest there.
Yeah, they're looking at their options and they're like, oh, that kind of looks like garbage to me.
Exactly.
So Emily, what should you specifically do? Which of these should you invest in first? And the answer is probably neither one of those 457 or 403Bs, if you're not receiving a match from the school, which is what you stated. But if you were, you know, then that would completely change the game here. It would be a different story. A full match or even a 50% match would be more than enough to cover those higher fees. So if you were receiving a match, then we'd recommend that you contribute enough to at least snag that free money. But since that doesn't sound like what you've got going on, the fees that are going to be associated with these plans are, in almost every case, they're going to be higher than what you would pay if you opted instead to open up your own individual retirement account, your own IRA. And so you can do that through one of the, you know, the best low-cost companies and providers out there like Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab. They also do a good job, and so does M1 Finance. They've got that slick app.
True, but also Emily made it sound like she's got more money than that to invest. She's got more than
$6,000,
right?
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like it.
Because she's like, can I contribute to both these accounts? And it's like, wow, if you're talking about socking away that kind of money, then that's another question, right? Because if you first max out the contributions to that IRA that you can open up on your own, after that, it's worth considering putting some of your retirement dollars into one of these other plans that you have access to, even if you don't have a match. Because even if the investment fees are high, the tax shelter can make up for it. Higher fees are terrible, but sometimes it just makes sense to hold your nose and do your best.
Necessary evil in this case.
Right, yeah. But here's what you need to look out for. Is that 403B run by an insurance company? Because most of them are. Look closely at the expense ratios on the funds that they offer, and then stick to the lowest cost funds, which they have, you know, in their portfolio. It's likely an S&P 500 fund or a total stock market fund. Those are our favorites anyway, but pay special close attention to the fund management fees, to that expense ratio, because that's going to tip you off as to what funds are worth investing in inside of those accounts and which ones are not.
That's right. Yeah, this is going to be a case when you grit your teeth, you bear it, and you take the tax deduction. Even though those fees are high, that's a real benefit that you'd be receiving. And Emily, also, there's a great site that we would recommend you check out called 403bwise.org that is worth looking at. They advocate on behalf of teachers and are fighting for greater transparency and access to just better plans for teachers all across the country as well. And so while it's great that you're working towards a pension, continuing to invest on your own, first inside of tax advantage accounts that you have access to, that'll make sure that you aren't wholly dependent on one source of income in retirement. We love that you're thinking through some of these different avenues in order to save for your future. It is important that you do things in the right order because, an individual retirement account is going to be slightly better if you don't have a match. But then beyond that, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out a 403B or a 457. And we wish you the best. Joe, let's go ahead and get back to the beer for this episode. You and I, we both enjoyed. A Master Shredder, and I just noticed on the label here, it's got a little 4 next to it. So I'm guessing this was the fourth iteration, or maybe the fourth time that they have done this beer.
Oh, no, sir. It's because it's quadruple dry hopped.
Is that really why?
4 times. That's what it says on the side here. Oh. Quadruple dry hopped IPA. So,
okay. So,
that's,
yes.
That's why the 4 is there. It's basically, and I don't think I've ever had a quadruple dry hopped IPA before. Basically, you know, when
you've had Don't Call It a Hot Lanta. That's a quadruple.
Is that? Okay. So I have
had
one.
Which is interesting because they didn't brand it that way. But I remember reading on the label and asking one of the brewers, like, why didn't y'all call it a quadruple dry hopped? And they're like, I don't know. They just wanted to call it a hazy IPA.
It feels like an over-the-top thing because double dry hopped is a big deal in and of itself. Like putting a lot of extra hops in at the end of the brewing process.
Right.
Basically, when you dry hop something, you're adding more hop presence. Mm. You're getting more of the notes in your nose and immediately on your tongue. But quadruple dry hop seems like it's like over the top and unnecessary until you have this beer. And you're like, oh no, that was necessary.
It's so good.
That was really good. I would say this also creates like a lot of bite, Matt. This beer, it reminds me of like Barks Root Beer. They always used to say like,
oh, yeah,
it's the one with bite or whatever. And I feel like the hop bite on this one is legit. Like it kind of does shred your tongue in a way with a bunch of hop flavor. So I feel like it's aptly named and the flavors were awesome. If you like hops, if you like the flavor that a ridiculous amount of over hopping can provide, then this is the beer for you.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. As far as the flavor profile, this was a fantastic dry hot beer. If you find yourself drawn to these hazy IPAs, then definitely check out some stuff by the Veil. I wanted to mention too on the label, it's funny because you say Master Shredder and we're talking about Ninja Turtles earlier, but on the label, they've kind of got these illustrations and they're kind of like rats.
Well, that's what he was. He was a rat.
But why they're four? So there's 4 of them because it's done 4 times, yeah. I guess it's a 4X beer.
Come on.
But the way that they have it drawn on the label, it also kind of makes me think of Queen, you know, with like the 4 heads, like in shadow, you know, hard relief with the light shining on their faces.
Sorry,
you know what I'm talking about?
I'm too young to remember that. You're much older than I am.
Bohemian Rhapsody, come on. It's not like it's a song I grew up listening to, but it's just, it's kind of one of those classics, man.
Sure you didn't, old man.
Please. Like, I actually grew up listening to Queen. I'm a child of the 90s, just like you, man. But back to the beer. This was fantastic. We recommend it. These guys are out of Richmond, Virginia. So if you happen to be in that area, you can probably find some of these beers there.
No doubt. Yeah, really tasty. So that's going to do it for this episode. For folks who want the show notes and links to any of the websites that we mentioned in our responses to the listener questions, you can go to our website at howtomoney.com. We'll list those out there for you.
That's right. And as always, we would love to hear from you. If you have a question for us, we would love it if you were to record a voice memo on your phone. It's super easy. And then email that over to us at howtomoneypod@gmail.com. Leave us a review if you haven't. Subscribe if you haven't. And until next time, Joel.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.